Hello, everyone. I'd like to open the Senate Education Workforce Development Committee meeting. We're going to start today by opening up a simultaneous public hearing on Senate Bill 250 and Senate Bill 246. And when we conclude that, we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 248. Senate Bill 250, would you kindly give us a summary, Linda?
Yes. Senate Bill 250 allows school districts to withdraw from and rejoin education school districts, requires the education service district to distribute prorated amounts of state funding available to the school districts that withdraw.
Senate Bill 250.
That was 250.
I'm sorry.
I misspoke.
I'm sorry. No. We need a public hearing simultaneously, 250 and 246, because they're intertwined. Okay?
Okay.
So, let me open a public hearing on 250, and we'll hear 250 along with 246 because they are intertwined. And we'll start off with 250, which is the full-day kindergarten committee.
250 is ESD.
250 is ESD. And
248 is where I'm going.
Okay. Senate Bill 248 extends the applicability of current laws that require school districts to offer half-day kindergarten and allows them to offer supplemental kindergarten, requires school districts to offer full-day kindergarten beginning with the 2015 through 2016 school year, changes the basis of calculation of aggregate days of membership for full-day kindergarten pupils. State school fund distributions for full-day kindergarten commences 2015 through 2016 distributions.
Okay. Thank you for your patience. It's full-day kindergarten day here today. And apologize for getting the bill numbers wrong. So I want to start off with the folks from the Kindergarten Task Force who've been working all year during the interim on their recommendation on how the state should set policy regarding upgrading from half-day kindergarten to full-day kindergarten. Welcome to all of you, and thank you for a lot of long hours during the past year.
Thank you very much. Before we begin, I want to make sure, does everybody have the report? No, we can make sure that
it's in the packet.
We have it up here.
What does it look like?
It should look like that. Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. My name is Karen Twain. I'm an administrator in the Tigard-Tualatin School District, and I want to thank you for hearing us today. We began work on Senate Bill 44 over a year ago now, is what it was called at the time, and we had broad representation. We had 14 committee members ranging from parents, administrators, teachers, classified, and we were asked to aid and advise legislative assembly, school districts, and public charter schools in developing and providing full-day kindergarten by the 2012-2013 school year. As we got into our work, we realized that most everyone agrees with the research to back it up that full-day kindergarten is a good idea and that we need it as soon as possible. Our charge was to come up with the proposal. We had unanimous approval from everyone on the committee to move forward with statewide implementation within the next 5 years. We're looking ahead and know that we need to spend on the front end of things if we want to decrease dropout rates and the achievement gap. Full-day kindergarten would help our students be ready for the new diploma standards and be college and career ready. Making the investment up front, we feel, is a better use of dollars when the budget is tight. And you will notice in here today that great attention has been paid to equity. We want all our students, not just some of them, in Oregon to receive access to full-day kindergarten and consequently reap the rewards that come with it. I'm going to speak briefly about capital, and then I'll hand it over to my colleagues. clearly one of the issues that comes up with full-day kindergarten is, do we have the space, do we have the buildings, the rooms? And we believe that by prioritizing within buildings and making use of every bit of space that it's possible. We figured if we had some assistance within the state for visitations to see how it's working in buildings, or sort of create committees or places where people can come to and see how and why it's successful in some places, that this could work. And basically do the thing that educators do best, which is be creative and think out of the box. 5 years allows for districts to start making plans and possibly floating bonds and taking care of the issues that they need to do. You'll hear a little bit more, but Measure 68 was one way we thought about that we might be able to generate some funds and really, in the end, just keep full day in kindergarten in mind with possible help with funding in this area. So, I'll let you introduce yourself. Go ahead.
I'm Brenda Lewis. I work in the Teaching and Learning Department in the Beaverton School District, and I was a member of this committee we worked together on last year. I'd like to talk a little bit about the type of kindergarten programs to be offered and looking at full-day kindergarten programs. As Karen has stated, we're looking at rolling this out in 2015-16 school year. Currently, we have approximately 96 school districts in the state of Oregon who are offering some form of full-day kindergarten program. And currently we have about 14,650 students that are enrolled in full-day kindergarten in the state of Oregon. The new Oregon Diploma Standards require that districts look carefully at how they capture quality instructional time, placing resources strategically to achieve this. Also, the state has identified learning targets for kindergartners, and teachers cannot provide equity in a 2.5-hour program, which is what we currently are funding. There's not enough time to differentiate instruction for students who are struggling learners, as well as those students who enter kindergarten with high proficiencies in content areas such as reading and math. Parents willingly pay for full-day kindergarten programs because they understand this and they see that full-day kindergarten is a value-added component to their child's education. Districts have initiated full-day kindergarten programs, and they've seen a return on their investment as measured by increased academic achievement for their students. And as we know, investment on the front end is a wiser use of dollars than investing more heavily in costly programs for students who are dropouts, who become incarcerated. And we know the cost involved in trying to have those programs is significantly increased. So until the 2015-2016 school year, one of the other components of this proposal is that we're asking that districts be allowed to continue to provide tuition-based full-day kindergarten as was provided in Senate Bill 44. So we would like that not be sunsetted so that we could continue tuition-paid programs until the advent of full-day kindergarten in the state of Oregon. Should I go ahead and go to the other?
Sure.
One of the conversations that we had in our committee was regarding attendance. Attendance currently is stipulated in Oregon as mandatory at the age of 7. However, as you know, we have many students enrolling in kindergarten and first grade who are 5 and 6 years old. There is no mandatory attendance in the state of Oregon. And providing funding for a program and then not requiring students to attend the program, it's not really being a good steward of taxpayers' dollars. All students who enroll in state-funded public education should be required to attend, and parents should abide by that commitment. Patterns of school attendance begin in kindergarten, and regular school attendance is an integral part of academic behaviors and in getting all of our students college and career ready. Compulsory attendance required at age 7 is still permissive in that it allows parents the opportunity not to enroll their child until they reach the age of 7. That is a parent decision. Parents can enter their child in kindergarten at the age of 6 if they so choose to wait until they turn 6. And while uncommon, parents may work with the school to request a half-day program if they provide compelling evidence to the school that it is in the best interest of their child not to be in a full-day kindergarten program.
If I could interrupt, you're referring to Senate Bill?
Senate Bill 246.
46 in that last.
Right.
Okay.
My name's Don Grotting. I'm currently the superintendent of the David Douglas School District in Portland. We have about 10,500 students. Prior to that, for 10 years, I was the superintendent of the Nissa School District, located in Eastern Oregon, of about 1,500 students. As you know, our current funding formula is that school districts will receive half weighting for all students attending their school, whether attending a full or half-day program. And as we alluded to, what we would like is full funding beginning in 2015 for those students. I think the important thing here is why. Why would we want to do this? There's overwhelming research that tells us we need to do this. A third of our students currently entering kindergarten are not ready for kindergarten, not able to do letter recognition or have the necessary math skills to be successful. Half of these students come from low-income families and are our children of color. Those are a growing population across the nation and in Oregon. What's more alarming is we're finding out when a student starts behind, they stay behind. We are only making gains and successes with 12% of the kids that start behind. And 30% of these students who start behind, they are our high school dropouts. These are the kids. And so I think while our teachers, administrators, school boards, communities are doing everything possible with the resources that we currently have, we're doing a great job. We are not going to make significant changes to the K-12 system in Oregon until we implement full-day kindergarten and eventually then start looking at our birth to four-year-olds. But I think the first step that we really need to take is to get full-day kindergarten for every student. As Karen talked about, this is an equity issue. The students that are not succeeding are our children of color and children in poverty, those that make up the largest percentage of our students that are not graduating. And I really believe that until we prioritize and do something to instill full-day kindergarten in every school district in Oregon, we will continue to not be able to catch up.
Thank you all, especially for your hard work on your meetings. I know I was in attendance at some of those meetings. Two things for some of our new committee members. The what I call the technical fix that you spoke about, Brenda, was the law that came about of an Attorney General opinion in 2008 that said public schools could not charge parents for that second half of a full-day kindergarten, which is common in about, a third of the school districts today. And so the legislature did this technical fix in the special session that essentially said that second half of kindergarten day that parents pay tuition for it would be the equivalent of sports, and therefore made it legal. Okay, that sunsets. So we have to extend that technical fix no matter what happens. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I want to ask some questions, and forgive me if it sounds like I'm leading the witness, but maybe that's what I do want to do here.
You mean you're not a neutral, dispassionate party here?
I do want to, I know that the people who, the conventional wisdom is always, we can't afford to do this. And but I do know, too, that the research supports a cost savings on this, and I wonder, Superintendent Grotting, you could talk about your experience in the schools you've been associated where you've seen the payoff, particularly getting to the third grade benchmarks that actually lowers and is responsible for a lower dropout rate as a result of going from 2.5 hours to 4.5 hours of kindergarten.
And I will speak with my experiences in NISA, since I've only been in the David Douglas School District now for 7 months. But in NISA, we were approximately 65% Latino population. And of that 65%, we had about a 45% ELL population. So many of those students, a large majority of those students, were coming into our kindergarten program with no English speaking skills. I truly believe if it was not for that program that we would not have experienced the success. Our schools and our district made AYP several years in a row recognized by ODE as a school district for closing the achievement gap, and many of our schools multiple years. And I truly attribute the number one factor for us achieving those goals is having full-day kindergarten, and not just a full-day kindergarten, a full-day rigorous program that allowed students to gain those English language acquisition skills, as well as start to gain the skills necessary to master the third grade benchmark and then eventually graduate from high school with the skills necessary to go on to post-secondary education or to enter the workforce and having the proficient skills necessary. And these were students, we had a very high free and reduced lunch rate of about 80-85%. And I would challenge you to look at scores. Our scores were match anybody in the state. And once again, I attribute that to our full-day kindergarten program, but it was also a way to then begin ramping up the rest of the K-12 system. And I think that has to be done. If once we attain full-day kindergarten, I think it will be incumbent on school districts then to look at their entire curriculum and ramp the rigor up throughout that curriculum.
Just to add one thing to what Don said, I think it's important to know and understand that the kindergartners have standards and learning targets, and when they are there for, let's say, 2.5 hours, and that 2.5 hours, you have to think of little five-year-olds getting from one place to the next and the transitions that go with that. In the end, the amount of time that you spend on reading or math and writing is not enough to get them to those targets for many, many kids. So it's very frustrating as a teacher, administrator, and even for the parents. Kids come to school, but it's very rushed and compacted, and for many of those children who have not had a lot of learning previous to that, it's a very frustrating experience. So we feel like this gives them the opportunity. And after having been a principal in a school that had half day and full day, when we compared the data, it was just night and day, and very clear cut.
And it's not, and we have to mention that sometimes in this debate we lose sight of the fact that we do pay for a half day. And a half day is very expensive. And I'm not so sure we get the value for that, because by the time the kids get their coats off and stop fidgeting, it's time to go home.
Yeah.
You know, my daughter went through kindergarten half day. It felt like we were going to the doctor's appointment or something. Mm-hmm.
The morning's back. Over.
Yeah. I think also there might be a thought out there that these kids can't do it. Our kindergarten began at 8 o'clock, and these kids went to school until 3:30, and they survived just fine, and they were there every day.
Other questions, Senator Shields?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to get a sense of how this is going to play out in my district in North and Northeast Portland, where my experience is that virtually every elementary school has full-day kindergarten. There are almost exclusively Title I schools. And if we did pass something like this, would they be able to hold on to any additional resources that Title I would make available? Or does this simply mean that, you know, Ainsworth will get state dollars to fund full-day kindergarten, and conditions at Humboldt Elementary are still going to be awful? I mean, Humboldt's a great school; they're doing, but they've got challenges. And part of the challenge is all their Title I money is going to full-day kindergarten. Can you help me understand what the likely hydraulics might be?
At the point that the state provides full-day services for all students, then the title dollars would be released to then be for other services. For example, they're spending a lot of money in Portland on full-day kindergarten. That money could then go to extended day programs for students, extended year, extended summer school. It could go to help the second, first through fifth graders in reading and math and small group and construction supplemental support. So the dollars would then be utilized, but what we couldn't do is supplant the dollars. So with the federal dollars, they can't be used to supplant a mandate from the state. So the general ed would pay for the full-day kindergarten programs, and then title dollars would be released. Okay. Does that make sense?
It does, follow, Mr. Chair. So you're putting on the record right now that your impression of how this would play out is that that Humboldt, Boys, Elliott, all those places at the end of the day would get more resources from the state, and then they would be able to hold on to their Title I dollars also.
They would get a resource of an additional FTE for full-day kindergarten. All students, all schools would get that. But then Humboldt then could determine how to then use their Title I dollars to meet the needs of the students in their school beyond the full-day kindergarten.
Okay. And just one last comment. I think, you know, there's that old saying that everybody wants to go to heaven and nobody wants to die. And occasionally in the variety of Ways and Means and Policy Committees that I'm on, I've been accused of talking incessantly about how much money we're spending on prisons in this state versus how much money we're spending on other things. And so on the one hand, if you invest here, you might spend less down the road, but you got to get the money from somewhere to invest here. And so I think that as we go forward on this discussion, we need to determine also as a state on whether or not prisons, when the Ways and Means process happens, whether or not prisons are off limits and we're just going to take money from other places and cobble this together, or are we all going to come together and say, hey, is this the best way to use our public safety dollar? Maybe we could use some public safety dollars on the front end rather than just the back end. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the neutral comment that I just gave.
Well, I think, though, that you touch upon a point that's very elusive. That is that, you know, high school dropouts are very expensive, but the costs don't necessarily show up on in our education budgets. They show up in our welfare budgets. They show up in our corrections budget. And it's difficult to quantify, but I think we pretty much documented in the research of your task force that those costs are far greater than the costs associated with a step like this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for all your work on this. And I served on the Education Committee last session and heard a lot of information about this issue and really do believe the data is there to show the benefit to kids. But I want to follow up on Senator Shields' point about the funding, because the way I read this, there isn't additional funding that comes along with this. It's taking the existing budget and just distributing it differently so that the school district gets the same amount of money. They just have to distribute it differently to pay for full-day kindergarten. Does this have additional funding for a full-day kindergarten, Mr. Chair? Perhaps
it
you can answer
not.
That.
It just says this is now the new state policy effective 2015-16 school year. And we went round and around about this. Your comments.
Go ahead, Don.
No, we would advocate for the additional half funding. I think what Senator Shields was alluding to would, because the state would provide the full-day kindergarten, would any of the title funds go away? And the answer to that would be no. Those title funds would just be able to use to enhance other parts of the education environment that have already been depleted by a reduction in our K-12 budget. Does that answer your question?
Well, it doesn't. If I could follow up, just it wasn't a very clear question. It was more of a comment. But if, for example, now I'm sure everyone in this room and everyone certainly here is hoping that by the time this goes into effect, we'll be able to increase the K-12 budget. But in worst-case scenario, if we can't, this still goes into effect, and the schools still have to implement full-day kindergarten, and there wouldn't be additional funding. They would take the existing K-12 budget and just plan accordingly. So did you have discussions about how that would impact grades 1 through 12 in a school, if that were to happen? I'm hoping it doesn't. I hope we can increase the funding along with this to really make it worthwhile. But if it doesn't for some reason, how do you... What are the discussions about the what you have to give up in grades 1 through 12 in order to pay for that additional half day?
We discussed it at length, and we had a number of resources or speakers come in and talk about different things. One of them was Ozzie Rose, who I know is in attendance today. And he talked about in 1981 when we were getting half day off. We had really nothing previous to that or nothing really set in stone. They used an 8-year timeline, but they started from scratch. And what Ozzie tells us and what we see historically is the districts put half-day kindergarten, the same kind of situation as this, in place well before that 8-year timeline. There was not a district that did not. So we tried to say what would be the magic number, and it was hard to come up with. We decided 5 years because we don't want this to go too long, and we hoped, you know, nobody really knows when the economy is going to start rebounding. But we felt like that was a pretty safe bet. And what happens in that is, yes, I mean, we've all been in meetings even this week, you know, making tough decisions about how to reallocate and prioritize and all those kinds of things. So in the end, that will be up to districts to think about what they need to do to make it work. But we faced this some years ago in Tiger-Tualatin, and I was one of the pilot schools to get full-day kindergarten off for everybody. And I remember sitting in meetings with K-12 staff and listening to the high school principals, everybody talk about this, and everybody decided, yes, this was worth the effort. So we made some hard decisions at that point just to make it work in our district. So I can't give you a firm answer on what that would be because each district is a little bit different. But what we do see is pretty universal agreement that this is really needed. So we think that people will start to prioritize and really think this out. And hopefully the 5-year timeline would give them enough time to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have Senator Starr is with us now, and I want to thank you all very much. Karen Twain was modest, and she didn't mention that when she was principal of Metzger, that's her school became School of the Year, and you what was the award?
I don't know that everybody wants to hear.
Oh no, go ahead. What was it?
We won Closing Achievement Gap Award many
and
years in a row. So
you attributed that to
it was all about full day kindergarten when it was all said and done. Truly made the difference. And on that note, thank you so much for hearing
thank
us.
You thank you very much. Senator Starr. Senator Starr is on 246, and I think you have what we would call a friendly amendment. 246.
Are you in public hearing for...
We're in public hearing on 246.
Perfect. Okay, so thank you very much. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr, State Senator representing District 15 in Western Washington County. Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 246. The Dash 1 amendments is a very, very minor change to the bill as it was introduced. The issue that at hand for folks that brought this bill to my attention is one for homeschool parents. And we wanted to make it crystal clear that if a parent decided partway through a school year that they wanted to pull their child out of the public school to homeschool, that they wouldn't be precluded by this particular statute. And so that's the minor change, and it's really in Section 2, Sub 2 of the bill. Just, you know, making it, again, crystal clear that parents of 5- and 6-year-olds may withdraw their child at any time, and that such withdrawal does not depend on the exceptions in ORS 339.030, which is the homeschool exceptions that are in the statute. Again, I don't believe it impacts the overall thrust of the bill, the desire of the sponsors of the bill, but it makes it clear that parents who choose to pull their child out partway through a school year may do so. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I would ask that that the Dash 1 amendments be adopted into the bill, and that we can get the bill underway. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I should have background with the committee a little bit that this bill came about because of the numerous attempts to lower the mandatory education age in the state, which is now 7, and the fights that always ensue over that. And we had some educators say, okay, if you don't want to have that fight, and I from the Hillsborough area, who said, let's at least do this. If kids do come into kindergarten, we do invest a time in them, let's at least make sure we can keep track of them. And I think this is a helpful amendment for the homeschoolers. So.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions, Senator Stark?
I just have one kind of miss maybe for you. If a parent starts a child at 5 years old and feels like they're not socially ready after a short period, how would you deal with that situation? If they want to pull them out and then restart them back at 6, how would that functionally work? It's more of a technical question. So I start my 5-year-old because I think they're brilliant. Come to find out they're, you know, average, and they're not quite ready
for school.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't take my wife's genes, they took my genes. And so how would I functionally pull them back out and wait till they're 6 to put them back in the school? I mean, is there any problem with that, I guess, one question.
I think that the problem that those aren't the kind of households that this was aimed at, and I think the truancy authorities is what was really at issue here, and these are not the households that were aimed at. It was the kids who would show up once a month.
Gotcha.
And to keep track of those families. So, Administrator Lindholm, did you have anything?
No, I think that covers it. Okay. The intent was...
I guess we don't create any problems with this current language then, I guess. Is.
None that I can see. We have Roger Williams signed up. I don't know if you're here on this issue, but I think you were with us in the last year when we were talking about this.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Haas and committee. My name is, for the record, my name is Roger Williams. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Christian Home Education Association Network, but I also have the concurrence of the Oregon Home Education Network, which is the generalist homeschooling network throughout Oregon. During one of the interim committee hearings, we had the two administrators come and explain the problem with the disruptions that were caused by parents who enrolled their kids in 5 and 6 year olds enrolled their kids, but then they weren't consistent in making sure their children were there, and that's bad for the children themselves because they're in, and then next time they're in, they're expected to know what they missed. It's hard on the other children because the teacher has to divert attention to catching up the child who had missed the time, and it's hard on the administrators because they're wondering, they have to figure out, okay, this child's not here. What happened to this child? And so they spend administrative time scurrying around trying to figure out what's going on. And that didn't make sense to me. I'm an educator too, and so I wanted to. And homeschoolers want to support our fellow educators in the public school system on this. So I suggested we talked, and I was a part of the suggestion that we have this bill. As it was originally drafted, though, it looked like it locked in children once they enrolled to the end of the school term. And our problem with that is that we believe parents know what's best for the child. And if they enrolled Johnny thinking, well, maybe Johnny can do it, and Johnny couldn't do it, we don't want Johnny locked into the end of the term because that will just be damaging to Johnny. So that's the... That's the impetus behind
the amendment.
The amendment. May I just say one more thing? I reemphasize what Senator Starr said. The intent from our perspective of this amendment is to make sure that the parents of 5 and 6 year olds can withdraw their children if they deem that that's necessary, and that they don't have to falsely claim to be homeschoolers to do it. There's the possible problem of a parent on February 5th saying Johnny's in, on February 6th saying Johnny's out. February 7th, St. Johnny's Inn. I recognize that, and what I suggest is that a school have a policy that on reentry, on re-enrollment, that that the principal or some other designated person have a conference with the parent and explain the seriousness of the educational process.
Questions or comments? Thank you. And, okay, back to full day kindergarten and Senate Bill 248. Tricia Yates. Tricia Smith, are you here together?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Chair Haas and members. I'm Tricia Yates with the Oregon School Boards Association. We represent the 1,400 volunteer elected school board leaders in our school districts, ed service districts, and community colleges in the state. I'd like to start off my testimony in Senate Bill 248 by stating that OSBA supports full-day kindergarten when accompanied by a separate appropriation, so fully funded, and at the local district's option to implement. To start off with, Oregon schools are in an unprecedented fiscal crisis. The funding level as proposed by the governor at $5.56 billion means a significant cut to school days, teacher and staff layoffs, increased class size, and a further reduction in academic and extracurricular programs. Members of our board returned last night. I accompanied them from a lobbying trip with our members of Congress advocating for federal resources to help districts free up the funds to pay for programs like full-day kindergarten and others. We're very concerned that federal support for special education funding and for Title I funding is on the chopping block, and we have little optimism for relief at hand. Like the chair, we support full-day kindergarten in Oregon, but our school board members are very concerned about pushing another unfunded mandate out into the future without the likelihood or the certainty that the funding will be there. Senator Shields mentioned that the money will have to come from somewhere, and Senator Bonamici noted, what if the funding won't be there within the five-year time frame? And we've listened to the Legislative Revenue Office tell us that Oregon's economic situation is likely to continue from 5 to 10 years. So we're very concerned about the funding being present. Currently, we're $1 billion short of the amount of funds needed to run current programs. The School Revenue Forecast Committee tells us that it would take $6.7 billion to run current programs today. We're at 5.7, and the proposed budget, as I mentioned, is 5.56. We know that full-day kindergarten is a priority for school districts and parents across Oregon. More than 100 of our districts offer full-day kindergarten, and one out of three kindergarten students, 14,000 of them, are in a full-day program right now with no funding for the state. To put it another way, requiring school districts to have full-day kindergarten is the equivalent of adding 20,000 students to our school system, but not putting any money in the state school fund to help districts pay for the cost. And I arrive at that by saying there's approximately 40,000 kindergartners at a 0.5 weight, so that's the equivalent of 20,000 students. In summation, when school districts have the financial resources to provide full-day kindergarten, they will. And that's why OSBA supports full-day kindergarten when there's state funding available to pay for it. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, AFT Local 6732, and the 21,000 members working in education all over the state. I'm here today to tell you that, like the chair, like OSBA, and like probably everyone, we support full-day kindergarten. It makes absolute total sense. We also support the governor's efforts to improve preschool for children. Texas provides preschool in its public schools to people, anyone who wants it. There are many improvements to our education system that we would support. We also support other improvements that are specifically mentioned as full-day kindergarten is in the quality education model, such as small schools, 340 students. We are closing schools at that level today, and we're putting those kids across town in bigger schools because we can't afford the small schools. We're moving backward, is my point. We're not moving forward, in truth, because it costs money. And we would ask you to not let this law either force changes, dramatic changes, and you should know what they are before you decide. They are more than tough choices. They are the existing students in our school system. If you force mandate school districts to do something, they're going to try to do it. But they're going to do it at the expense of the other things that you expect of them. Already, we can't do many of the things you expect. Tricia mentioned that we are about $1 billion short of what it takes just to do what we're doing now. Well, we're also $3 billion short of what we know it would take to provide 90% of the students with the standards that you've already got in the law, including lots of things which none of us want to give up. There is a statute right now that says the legislature shall fully fund Head Start by 2004. I think we're less than 60% of the students now. They've never been fully funded. That's the other alternative that could happen with this statute. If school districts say, look, what do we give up? Science, the fourth grade, or we run the gambit for not implementing full day K because we don't have the money. Those are the choices that will happen. One of the things we'd like you to do, we'd ask you to do, is give us some guidance. If this bill doesn't come with money, new money, give us some guidance on the things you think we should give up to implement it.
Well, I would say that we had a pretty good pre-credentialed task force during this past year of real people who actually work in the schools, who spent a great deal of time on the dynamic you're warning against, and they still recommended adopting full-day kindergarten as an alternative to the half-day or the 2.5 hours that we have now.
Mr. Chair, let me just say, and I should have said this at the very beginning, OSEA's member Jean Underhill served on that committee. We absolutely support full-day kindergarten. Jean works in kindergarten in Lake Oswego. We know the value of kindergarten. However, we did not support moving the bill forward without a requirement that the legislature fund the mandate.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I need to add as well that Patty McLeod from the Hillsborough School Board, who's also on the OSBA Board of Directors, was very pleased to be a part of the task force. She similarly supports full-day kindergarten, as does OSBA, but she consistently pointed out the need for full funding, not only for operations, but asked the task force to look at facilities issues as well.
Questions? Thanks.
Sure.
Senator George.
You know, real quickly, just let me ask you this question. Would you envision that this bill be redrafted or amendment be put in this that would silo some money for full-day kindergarten? Or, I mean, how would a trigger work if we wanted to pass something, but it only triggers when we actually put money into it? Would it be a silo of money, or would it be a specific allocation of money? I mean, how would that structurally work from your perspective?
It would be an increase in the state school fund sufficient to fund it.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. I guess the point is that we're already $1 billion in arrears to you folks. So I throw another $20 million at you and say, go at it. I'm not sure exactly where that gets us. So are you asking that there actually be a line item that covers K-12, that covers full-day kindergarten, or you just say just throw some more money in there? Because how do I tell if we funded you or not? How do I not vote for an unfunded mandate? That's what I'm asking.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator George, I would suggest that you not put the mandate in the law until you have the money to fund it, and I'm not suggesting that you fund it out of other education funds. That is my point. Please don't take it out of the rest of education. Find us new money. I have my own ideas. You probably have yours, but not out of existing education money.
Senator Shields.
Mr. Chair, I was wondering if any of you or any of the people involved in this have thought about ways that we could begin putting aside some money to implement this in 5 years. I know in ways and means, we always had a difficult time trying to tie the hands of future legislatures. But I know that we have, for example, a provider tax that tends to stay in the provider and the healthcare silo. There are ways that you could set up, you know, trust funds and things like that. I was wondering if that's been explored, if, for example, and I'm sure Senator George would love this idea, we reformed Measure 11, the mandatory minimum sentencing law, but we wouldn't actually see any payoff for that for 5 years because the changes you would make to the law now you wouldn't actually see till 5 years down the road.
Thank you, Chair Haas and Senator Shields. We, as an education coalition, there are 9 different groups together, have been working with Ways and Means members to look at a path out into the future, 5 to 10 years, where we could try to work toward adequate funding for a number of areas, not only full-day kindergarten, but professional development for teachers to work with our variety of students, a whole host of things that we need to fund overall. And we would certainly see this as a real need within that whole scope of activities.
That's correct. And our understanding of the additional cost is, and I don't know if you said that, is that it's about $100 million a year, $200 million a biennium for operations, and we don't have a cost for capital costs, the kinds of remodel that would have to happen in buildings.
Well, I would just say, you know, the 10 years that I've been with this issue, that a cost is elusive. It's impossible to set a cost on this because of the absorption factor and because of the sort of the value you really don't have with a half day. And you can make the argument that because so many of those expenses are already there that you're not getting your money's worth for a half day. And by going to a full day or 4.5 to 5 hours, your cost would not double. Your cost would not double. It may go up 20% or 30%, and I know the task force wrestled with this very dynamic. And so that's why the costs are so hard to pin down, and it certainly wouldn't be that high. And the real cost to me is the kind of the notion that the task force I talked about all last year, that had this state done full-day kindergarten in 2001, 10 years ago, that the research would suggest that perhaps the social costs today would be much less in this state, and the budget deficit we're facing down the hall in the Ways and Means offices would be much less than it would cost to add full-day kindergarten. So to continually argue for the status quo is to continually put off these cost decisions that in the long run will pay for themselves. So,
Mr. Chair, let me just say I'm not arguing for the status quo. We support full-day kindergarten, but we do not support pretending that there is no impact on the rest of education, and education is teetering in this economy. And depending upon which governor you listen to, the last one or this one, it's a long time coming before we get out of it either way. Fortunately, it's not quite as long with our current governor, I'm happy to say. But still, there is no one telling us we're going to have the money to do this or that we're going to be able to recover what we're losing in the other committee down the hall right now by 2014.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have anyone else signed up on full-day kindergarten that didn't make it to the sign-up list? Okay. I very much want to thank Karen Twain, Brenda Lewis, and Don Grodin again for all your help on the task force all last year. The committee will see a letter of support from the Superintendent of Schools, Susan Castillo, and stay tuned. There'll be more on this. And I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 248. And Senate Bill 246. And because of my detanglement when we started, we are in a public hearing on Senate Bill 250. That is our ESD opt-out bill. We have some amendments coming, but not yet done. And we have a list of people who have signed up. Just a warning to everyone to condense your remarks. We are forced to close down the hearing 2:30 today. So I will start with people who have come by more than 100 miles. Sally Storm, Bob Sari, Lloyd Hartley. start. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Bob Serry. I'm the superintendent of Harney County School District 3, which is Bernhine School District. I'd like to speak to you today basically on the general perception that ESDs eat up a lot of reserves and don't do anything for school districts. By way of background, I've served as a superintendent since 1992. I've been in Santiam Canyon School District, North Lake School District, Harney County Crane, and then Harney County 3. My background primarily as an administrator has been in a rural school district. Harney County, I'd just like to impress upon you that I didn't believe that the testimony that you heard and that was noted in the paper from the Baker Boys is really representative of entire Eastern Oregon. Eastern Oregon really, I don't think that they're a very good spokesman for the importance of an ESD to us.
We had some girls from Baker, too.
I could sing my Baker Boys song as well and go on with that. But I'd like to talk about the geography of Harney County and the fact that there's 10,000 square miles of property, of land out there. And if you take that land mass, and we could start out at Portland and go down I-5 and go from I-5 to Eugene and go from Eugene over to Florence and then back to Seaside and back to Portland, and you're going to get the amount of geography that we have. The school system that sits in there right now, we have, of the 197 school districts that we have in the state of Oregon right now, we have 8 surviving K-8s and 1 Union High School district that survived the mergers of 1992. And the amount of student body that we have, or students that we have in the district, are roughly around 1,500 kids. Those 1,500 kids have survived and been educated in a system in which the ESD provides many, many important services. And these services that if you would just be with, labor with me for a little bit here, the direct services that we do, that the ESD does for us, are speech and language, the extended school year, audiology, VOAG program in the school improvement area, after-school programs, media library, GED, instructional services, STRUT, music teachers, teacher professional development. In the technology area, the ESD has brought Harney County from the Commodore network to a wireless network and has done an outstanding job of things that none of the district could have ever afforded to do and link them together. Out of all the services that are provided for us, there's roughly around $800,000 of expense that the ESD takes for us. If we were to opt out as Harney 3 and opt out our services from the ESD, where would we go? Where could we go and receive these services? If the ESD were suddenly to be gone, the amount of money that would be passed due through us would be about $121,000. What could we do with that? How could we replace these services?
Superintendent Surrey, though, there's no requirement, there's no mandate to opt out, nor is there a plan anywhere to eliminate ESDs.
I'm speaking to the consequences if the ESD were to be closed and were to be opt out, or we'd have a choice to opt out. If those services weren't there, we couldn't basically meet the needs that we have.
But this legislation wouldn't do that.
I understand that. I would define opt out as the beginning of the end of the ESD if we were to do it. And the other point that I've tried to make is the fact that the services that the ESD does for us in Eastern Oregon and Harney County obviously is different than the services that are needed here in the urban areas and in the larger ESDs, larger school districts need. That I don't think their choices to opt out of the major ESDs definitely would have a consequence on the school districts that stay. And if that precedent were to be established, the impact on what could happen to our district And I'm not talking about overall ESDs being changed totally. And I just go back to my original premise there that yes, the ESDs do eat up a lot of resources, but they do a lot of things for us. And what they do for us in Eastern Oregon is considerably different than what they do for the districts, the larger school districts here in the urban areas. We really couldn't survive without them. With the declining enrollment and the things that are happening to our communities and our schools, we haven't got any way of paying for the things that we need to maintain services and the efforts that.
If I could just stop you there, though, just I don't want to continue this because the legislation doesn't call for that. So,
okay,
we're not closing down ESDs. If it's a good relationship, there's no reason why it shouldn't continue with the school district and the educational service district. So I kind of want to move down the panel here because we've got a lot of people to file through.
I understand, but I hope you understand I wasn't trying to speak not to the question. I was trying to speak to the importance of it and the difference of the needs that Eastern Oregon has for ESD services versus what they have in the opt-out a pattern that many of the larger school districts are trying to do.
I understand. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. You all look kind of smart and imposing up there, so I'm a little nervous, so please put up with that. I'm the superintendent of the McKinsey School District, and we're up the McKinsey River about 45, 50 miles from Eugene. It's beautiful up there. If you ever want to come and visit, we'd love to have you. Bring your fishing pole. Our district has about 225 students. We have an elementary, a middle school, and a high school. And we try desperately to leverage our funds to help each and every child up there. So I'd like to tell you a story about our students and their sort of love affair with the ESD, if it were. When I talked to my dean of students yesterday and said I have to be out of the district today because I'm going to testify at a hearing about a bill and explain the bill to him, he looked at me with all seriousness and said, "Sally, that would be the death knell of our district." And that sounds pretty dramatic, I know. But I think every expert who's looked at the numbers recognizes that it would be the beginning of the end. I understand you don't want to talk about that, but I need to mention that if there is opt-in or opt-out, we'll stay in. I can guarantee you we will stay in. But our services would drop a lot if the big districts dropped out, and our cost would rise. No one disagrees with that. And so, you know, we're looking at not getting the services that we've come to just love and need for each and every student in our district. So I just want to clearly give you an idea of how we really need this district to stay open and to have the services they have right now. First of all, we use them for school improvement. And we have a great person that we've developed a relationship with at the ESD named Marianne Oakes. She comes in and helps with literacy and math. Our teachers at my district when I got there had never had staff development. I mean, that sounds bizarre. But they're remote, and they had never gone in and gotten staff development, and they never really knew how to do it. And so Marianne has come out and developed a relationship with our teachers and taught them so many things. Our test scores have improved, largely because of our association with Marianne and the other people at the ESD who have come and worked with us. The ESD also gives us access to the University of Oregon experts who, I mean, they know so much. We would never have access to them if it weren't through the ESD. And we get their research and we are able to go back and use it in our district and improve things. Technologically, there's a lot of big words I don't understand, but they run our email and they have an email administrator who fixes the email when it goes down. Our person at our district wouldn't know how to do that. And so if all of this went away, we would have to have an email server. We'd have to put in infrastructure that we don't have right now that the ESD has supplied for us. We don't even know if we would be able to get connectivity. That's a big word for me. We don't know if we'd be able to find someone to provide us with internet service up there because the ESD has teamed with the University of Oregon and other places to provide for the remote areas. So that's a real scary thing to us. We have a psychologist and behavioral disorder specialist who comes to our district 3 days a week. And that probably sounds kind of strange to you, but we don't have counselors anymore. And we have students with unbelievable needs. We have autistic students. We have students with mental health issues. And we really utilize our psychologist, and he comes 3 days a week. We have a speech therapist that comes 1 day a week. By law, we have to have a speech therapist, and we get these guys through the ESD, and they're really very good. Okay, so we also have students that we can't service at our district because their needs are so great. So like behavioral disorder students and life skills students, our teachers are not equipped. We can't do that. So we have to send them to classrooms in town that the ESD runs and runs very well. Our ESD has also helped us secure grants because we have a consortium and we can appeal and get grants that we wouldn't even be able to apply for if we weren't in the consortium with ESD. So if we do this opt-in, opt-out thing and services start dropping, we will have to look at how much money would it take for us to get these services elsewhere. First of all, we spent $32,000 out of pocket last year for all the services I described to you, plus a bunch more. That was how much we had to come up with in addition to the money provided by the state. I've been told that if we were to opt out, we would get $106,000. So that would give me about $138,000 to get something going. Okay? If we tried to get somebody to come up and do educational consultants like Marianne has done with us and our other experts that have come in, it would be probably about $1,600 a day. That's the going rate. If we had 20 days with somebody like that, it would be $32,000 a year. I'm really worried about the technological piece because our person now doesn't have to deal with any of the email or any of the network stuff, and he can't do that. And it's pretty hard to find somebody with that kind of background to come all the way up the river and work on computers and do things. So we would have to hire somebody with all that expertise at probably about $40,000 a year or so to do what now the ESD does for us. The infrastructure would be $20,000 to $30,000 to try to replace what they're doing, and then we don't even know if we'd get hooked up. Finding a psychologist, our psychologist told me yesterday it would be about $136,000 a year to find a psychologist in private practice to drive up the river and spend 3 days with us. A speech therapist told me he'd charge probably about $35,000 in private practice. We would not be able to send our students into the classrooms because they would close down. Even if one of our big districts closed down, we would probably not be able to access a classroom for our BD children or our life skills children. That means we'd have to hire a teacher in our district that could deal with those children and have a classroom catering to them. And that would be about $72,000. So if you total all of that up, it comes to $338,944. And if I take my $138,000 off of that, then I'm down to about $308,000. And I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to make sure that our tax dollars are spent wisely. And I appreciate that so much. And I know that you're responding to a couple of rogue ESDs, that it was sickening what they did. It makes all of us as educators embarrassed and sick at what they did. But, you know, this broad brushstroke that's being painted of ESDs, it's not fair. For example, my ESD, the Lane ESD, is very well run by Deb Egan. They leverage the money like you can't believe. I'm on the budget team. I see what we do. I mean, every cent, we just squeeze as much as we can from it. So I would ask you, as you're looking at this taxpayers' dollars, to think of my students up the river in McKinsey and think about the fact that, you know, don't they have a shot at an equitable education just like their rural counterparts, I mean their urban counterparts in big districts? I think they do, and I think you would believe that too. And truly, if you do the opt-in, opt-out, our services will go away. It truly will be the beginning of the end. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, for traveling here. You all look fairly smart and imposing to us. I think that the needle we're trying to thread here is to make this work for the small schools, to get the economies of scale for the schools like you that have to share speech pathologists and special needs. So that, and making our dollars go further so that we have more money to send to your school district, period, and just general school support. So we'll just go to you next, and we'll take questions.
Thank you again for your time. I'm Lloyd Hartley, the superintendent in the Glendale School District, also representing Douglas County in the southern part. And, you know, I'll echo some of those things, but to not repeat, I just want to I think the big issue here is cost effectiveness. And one of the things that the ESD has done with us is we've been able to collaborate services such as business services and payroll that saves our district approximately $40,000 a year. Maybe not a lot in the bigger districts, but for us, that's a significant amount of money that we're able to put back towards kids. And again, we have the services that we'd be losing if we had to find them on our own, such as the school psychologists, speech therapists, and all that. And when we talk about equity of services, we have a kid that is a lifetime Glendale kid that in his high school senior year in a car accident had TBI through a car accident. Without services available from the ESD, the progress this child has made would not be there because of the lack of expertise in the rural areas. And when we talk about equity issues, that's where it really hits home for me, is that if right now we're very thankful that the larger districts in Douglas County support the ESD and there's not talk there of pull out of them, but as economic times change and if that's on the table every year for us, it makes it very difficult to be able to plan. And so when we look at these kids with equity of services, we're losing a large population in the rural areas to be able to find these. Because a kid that has a car accident in Roseburg or Eugene, our kid in Glendale should have the same services to continue his quality of life and to better himself, just like a kid in Roseburg and Eugene should. And I just fear that if the larger districts do pull out, our expenses to that would be astronomical, that services would really decrease for those kids. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you. And Ms. Gorm, I didn't mean to run you off. Do you have any questions or comments?
Thank you.
I'd like to go to Barbara Jorgensen, Jerry Washington, Jim Mabbitt. Do you three at a time? No?
I'd like to reserve my time for, I think there's school district folks that would rather hear from me.
Fair enough. Okay. Bob Saxon, Karen Gray, Ray Sullivan.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the committee. Rob Saxton, I'm superintendent of the Tigard Tualatin School District, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. I think that all of my colleagues and probably all my colleagues across the state right now are looking really hard to see how we can figure out to find efficiencies in our school district. Anything that we can do, I think I'm going to spend the majority of my spring and have spent the majority of the last couple of months already trying to figure out how are we going to run a school district with the dollars that we have available to us as we head into the next school year. And I think that you all are looking for efficiencies too. And so one of the places that we're looking is at the ESDs. I think it's interesting that the purpose for ESDs originally was about efficiency. I mean, there were really two reasons for ESDs. One is to create an economic efficiency. A lot of the things that we do at ESDs are to take high cost, low incidence programs and try to deliver those in a cooperative way so that they're more efficient for all the school districts that are combined. And the second part has to do with equity of service. And so we have school districts that are small and rural, and also, you know, large and urban. And the idea is that if a child is able to access something large and urban, that we also want students who are small and rural to be able to have the same services so that we have equity of education across the state. So essentially, an ESD is a co-op. And really the question I think that we have to all consider and think about in kind of a common sense way is, does a well-run co-op create efficiencies, or does it not? And I would assert that a well-run co-op does create efficiencies. One of the things that happens in a co-op is if the biggest member of a co-op leaves, it causes the efficiency of that co-op to diminish. Now try to think of an analogy, and the best analogy I could think of was, if you had a neighborhood with 10 homes, and they created a co-op around landscaping services. So they contract with somebody who's going to offer landscaping services for all the homes, but one of the homes has a yard that's four times bigger than the next biggest yard. And that yard, that homeowner says, I'm going to pull out from this co-op because my yard is bigger and it's easier to service, and I can get better service for less dollars if I pull out of that and have my yard done. That's great for that person, and they may actually be able to accomplish that. But they're going to have to drive through a neighborhood with yards that aren't as good as their own in order to get to their house. And so they're going to have a neighborhood that looks pretty poor around their home. And so will they have accomplished what would be for the greater good of all the people who live in the neighborhood, which is what we're trying to accomplish really as a state and an organization when we talk about trying to educate our kids. And so I think that we run the risk of having some neighborhoods, some parts of the neighborhood look good and other parts of the neighborhood look not very good when it comes to equity of services for our students. I can speak for the ESD that I belong to, which is the Northwest Regional ESD, and I think we have a really good model and a very well-run ESD in the Northwest Regional ESD. The Tigard-Tualatin School District has about 14,500 students ADMW, and as a member of the ESD, we think that we find economies because we are a member of the ESD. And I listened to some of the services that have been talked about earlier that other school districts receive. We receive those exact kinds of services through our ESD. And when we do our financial modeling about if we were a member of the ESD or if we weren't a member of the ESD, we find that we have efficiencies because we're a member. I think probably today I'm the superintendent from the biggest school district that you're going to hear testify. And there's probably a reason for that, because just above us, I think we start to find the break-even point on those kinds of efficiencies when it comes to size of a school district. If we were a bigger school district in the 20,000-plus range, we might not be able to find those same kinds of efficiencies. In fact, we probably could not. And so, but I do think it's really important to remember that the 10 biggest school districts in our state serve 41% of the student population in the state. So 59% of the students in the state are in districts that are smaller than the 10 biggest. And the Tigard-Tualatin School District is the 8th biggest in the state. So our 14,500 students are part of that 41%. And if we're going to talk about how we're going to serve all kids in an equitable and efficient way in the state, I think the best way to do that is through ESDs. And you could ask me some questions like, what would happen if we did that and some district opted out? Why wouldn't you contract with the district? Why wouldn't Tigard-Tualatin work perhaps with the Beaverton School District on services? I would ask you a couple of questions. One would be, why would Beaverton want to do that? Beaverton would want to leave the ESD if they chose to do that, or if Portland left theirs, would choose to do that because they think that they can get a bigger bang for their buck. And so if we try to get services from them, I can only assume that we're going to be able to buy those services only if we're able to provide the right amount of money to them to provide those services. And if it becomes more expensive for us to contract with the district than it would with the ESD, who has a mission about equity of service and also has a mission about efficiencies, then I don't know how we're going to get that from a bigger school district than we are. And the last part of that is, I have a say in what happens at my ESD. We get to participate in the decision-making there, and we wouldn't get to do that if we worked with a bigger school district. So that would be the end of my comments. Thank you.
Again, it's the same comments to some of the other superintendents. I'm not sure what the threat is here. There's nothing that requires you to opt out.
Senator Haas, the idea is that definitely there's nothing that would require us to opt out, and Tigard-Tualatin probably would not opt out. But if the two bigger school districts in our region, Beaverton and Hillsborough, opted out, the economy of scale would go down, and the efficiencies that are created for all the rest of the school districts in our region would disappear.
So if I could follow that, then that Beaverton, for example, which would rather have its own money to spend than its own special needs and
Yes.
and what have you. How is that fair then to Beaverton if they're in effect asking to support this co-op that
right.
you described? Shouldn't they be allowed to do what makes the most sense for them?
Well, it may be that it would be, if the Beaverton School District opted out, that for the 38,000 students in the Beaverton School District, that there might be something more for them. But I don't want to forget that the ESD serves 105,000 students in our region. And again, 41% of the students are in the 10 biggest school districts. The other 59% deserve equity of program. And that is one of the hallmarks of education in the state of Oregon, the way that we currently provide funding in this state, is that we want to have equity across the state. And that's why we have a more equitable funding system, and it's why we have ESDs. And if we do this and people take their money and run, it's going to create inequity for other students across the district or across the state.
How do you know that? Because the Department of Education challenged us on that, saying, you know, there's this theory that if the bigs pull out, it will make it more expensive for the smalls, but there's no evidence of that. The dollars would be prorated. And so you're speaking in just theoretical terms.
Well, Senator Haas, I have not. I do have some financial documents with me today. I haven't been prepared to speak to those, but I do think that there can be some financial modeling that would show that when those big districts do pull out, it would very much be like the co-op model that I described. And that's why I tried to describe that co-op model of the neighborhood. If the biggest home went away, all the other people in the neighborhood would suffer to pay a higher price for the same yard.
Okay. Questions? Rob Saxon. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. Excuse me. My name is Larry Sullivan. I'm the special education director in the Eugene School District. Prior to that, I was an assistant superintendent in the urban district in Ohio. And I like the opportunity to testify in support of our most vulnerable children out there. I also like to reiterate and thank the two superintendents for making most of my points in front of me, so I can make them much shorter. My concern, and I think all of our concern, is as you look at this bill and you look at the current funding mechanisms and supports that ESDs provide across the state, that we ensure that the outcomes of this bill or the changes in the current structure really provide the necessary, not just adequate, services for students, the most vulnerable students we have. The Eugene District serves 2,600 special education students. About 130 of those students are the most severe, needy students. And in conjunction with Lane ESD, we provide those necessary services. As my colleague just said, one of the big concerns I have, certainly we're at a breaking point too. We could pull out. In fact, I did the numbers. We could pull out, and we'd probably end up spending about $1 million more to provide the same services from our general funds as we're doing with ESD. That's not the point. It's fair and equitable across the street. When Sally Storm has a student with real intense needs, you know, our IDM from our district, I don't begrudge this to the smaller district, really generates the capacity in dollars in the ESD to provide those services across all students in Lane County. It's not just about Eugene School District or Springfield School District or Bethel School District. It's about the students in Lane County, those vulnerable students. So the point I'd like to leave you with is, yes, we can do. We have options, and actually one quick option is that we are doing some things at ESD that are following your process, which is that we at Eugene School District are the subcontractors for Lane ESD to provide the low-incident vision, hearing impairment, deaf and hard of hearing, OTPTs for the whole county. At the same time, we're working with Lane ESD to look at service level changes. Services need to change as our needy kids become more apparent in our districts. And finally, you know, I left a budget committee meeting this morning in which we're going to be cutting a large number of our support staff, whether it be special education staff, whether it be staff development specialists. And these are things that if ESDs have the capacity through funded dollars to provide us. Thank you.
Comments?
Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
I'm new to the committee, so I come into this kind of trying to get a depth perception. And I want to take up real quickly the example the superintendent gave us about a co-op. Right now I belong to a co-op, and there is one single provider that mows grass in our co-op. I have to pay that price because I'm part of the co-op. I go out and I get a bid and I find out that I can have my grass mowed at half the price. So, but I'm not allowed out of the co-op. Everybody has to go to that same provider at the same whatever fixed price it comes out to be, regardless of how many executives they have working at ABC Landscaping. I get the option to opt out. I get somebody who will come in to the neighborhood and will mow my grass at half the price. And my next-door neighbor says, hey, that's a great idea. Can that guy, while he's in here cutting my grass for half the price, also mow my lawn at half the price? And all of a sudden, you get two providers. And then you may have three providers. And it seems like to me that, I mean, again, I'm new to the committee, but based on the testimony we've had over the last couple of days on this issue, it seems like to me that you want to have as many innovative providers doing as many innovative things as you possibly can, where school districts can pick and choose who does the best service for the best price. And it seems like to me a monopoly rarely works. And the complaints I get is that this monopoly isn't working for a lot of school districts. And I understand the concern about change. I'm with you. I understand nobody likes change, especially in times of uncertainty. But in this situation, the option of having more providers seems like a great idea to me. So if you could respond to that, your co-op example is perfect for me. I just sure. That's exactly why I would say that this should be done, not why it shouldn't be done.
Chair Haas, Senator George, the problems of an analogy. So maybe you shouldn't do that. I think that the point is that in my story, the largest yard pulled out. If I'm a landscaper and I look at coming in and mowing the yard that's really big, I can probably make a better profit margin by mowing that yard than I can a little postage stamp next door that requires lots of maneuvering. And so the issue is that the largest pulls out, and it makes it more expensive for everyone else. And that is the issue. School districts are going to go out and try to find the very best way to find service for all of theirs. In our current service model, we can take 50% of the dollars as flow through. So we take the services that make sense for us. And that is the other important part. If you're a large school district, the only way that this works for you, because we're a fairly large school district, we're third largest in the Northwest region, the only way that that works for us is to be really smart about how we use the dollars to purchase services through the ESD, the 50% that we can't take as flow through. The other 50% of the services that we get as flow through, we're going to go out and do just what you said, figure out absolutely the best way to get the bang for our buck to deliver services to kids in our region. Now, every ESD is a little bit different. They don't all have that funding stream or that funding model. It's how ours works. It's part of the reason that I would say that it does work. But if the biggest districts leave, it becomes more expensive for all the other districts, because what we have are low incidence, high cost programs. If we have a student who has severe autism in our district, but we only have one, and Beaverton has two, and Tillamook has one, we're going to create one program where those students can come and get the kind of services that they really need and get the adults who are expert, and they're going to provide that program for a really low cost as compared to us having to hire two full-time people to be with that person full-time with that student who has really severe autism in our district, which is going to be very expensive. And so that's how the co-op works. And if Beaverton leaves and all the students who have autism like that in their district are gone, it creates an inefficiency for us to now come together and create that if we don't have the economy of scale that allows for that kind of a service to be low cost to all districts in the Northwest region. And so it's like that. If the big yard goes away, it makes it harder for all the smaller yards to get the services that they need for the cost that they're currently paying.
Real quick follow-up, sir, George. I guess... In my business, anyway, the competitiveness is how much overhead you have. The delivery of the service is the variable cost. Okay, so what you're basically saying is that the mechanism, the overhead, is so onerous for all of these things that when you divide it up among the variable services, the variable price, that the overhead allocation for the variable price becomes overwhelming. What you're arguing to me here is that the bureaucracy or the administration is so heavy on delivering these services that when you break it out into a variable cost, that when you allow school districts to go away, that when they don't cover their part of the overhead cost. What we heard the other day from the example in Baker County is that what they found is that the overhead cost was significantly less when they broke the service down and they had multiple bidders. And so your analogy only works if there is a huge overhead, and that huge overhead has to be maintained. I would say that I haven't been convinced either way yet, but I haven't been convinced that the bureaucracy or the overhead that you have to maintain that's allocated to each program services necessarily attach the variable costs that you have. And in your example of the autistic child, I would envision that, A, the Education Service District wouldn't go away. They would provide a service. Beaverton would provide a service. Hillsborough would provide a service. And whoever could get the economies of scales would provide the service at the lowest price. And that seems good to me. And so I guess my problem is you're asking me to make the assumption that the overhead is necessary to deliver the service, and I'm not sure I agree with you there, just so you know, and that's kind of where I need to be to understand your point.
Senator Haas, Senator George, I appreciate your comments. I have some thoughts about how I would respond to that, but I also want to recognize that it's 2:29, and I have a colleague who I know would really like to address the committee if I could.
Go ahead.
I can't do this in 1 minute. So greetings to the committee, and a special greeting to Senator Shields, who represents the westernmost part of Park Rose School District, and also to Senator Bonamici. We're both on the local public safety coordinating council together in Portland. I'm Karen Fisher Gray, and I'm the superintendent of schools for Park Rose School District in Portland, Oregon. I've been the superintendent for the last 4 years in Park Rose, and before that, I was superintendent in Coos Bay School District. I'm the chair of the Education Enterprise Steering Committee and a City of Portland appointed Planning and Sustainability Commissioner. This is the second year in a row that I have testified here regarding ESD and the opt-outs. Last year, I was the chair of the Shared Regional Services Subcommittee of the Education Reset Committee. We met half of the year with leaders from the legislature, K-12 school districts, and ESDs, and together we developed several models for improving ESD effectiveness and efficiency and presented those. I also spent some time comparing the difference in ESD services from one ESD to the other, since I have been superintendent in two different districts the exact same size. And so here I am again. What opting out means for districts, larger districts, for the school districts in Multnomah County, the MESD serves 90,000 students that range from Portland Public Schools, the largest school district in the state, to one of the smallest school districts, Corbett. At a recent meeting last week when the districts served by the ESD got together with business managers to discuss the percent of transit or flow-through dollars that we get, we came to the conclusion and spoke about how important it was that we work together to purchase needed services through the resolution process. We have an opportunity every year to get together and decide what it is we need and how we're going to work together to get them. While we were studying how we could possibly increase choice and flexibility through our transit dollars, we also recognized our incredible need to depend and work with each other, including Portland Public Schools. Last year, Senator Haas, you asked me a question. It threw me off. I went completely blank. And another superintendent attempted to answer the question for me, but now I have an answer to the question. I've had a year to think about it. Maybe I'm not that quick on the draw, but anyway. The question was, could Park Rose get its services from Portland Public Schools? And the reason I realized I was so stumped is it's never been anything that's been brought up. It isn't anything we've ever talked about. And my answer was that if the data warehouse project were any indication of Park Rose getting any kind of data dashboard from the other school district, the answer was no, because to date I haven't gotten a data dashboard out of that project. And that is the one thing that may have happened through a partnership with Portland Public Schools. They're working on it. They're trying hard, but we still don't have it. I have never heard Portland Public Schools ever offer to Park Rose, Centennial, David Douglas, Gresham, Barlow, Reynolds, or Riverdale services if we paid for them. I think that we're all trying to provide for our own school districts, and I'm really not sure that that's something that they are considering at this point. In the future, maybe, but not right now. The Newburgh School District provides school improvement services to neighboring school districts for little or no cost. That's true there, but that's not true where I live. While I work together with the other school improvement efforts across the county, they don't provide services for Park Rose, and I don't provide services for them. The model does not work in our county, and it's nothing that we need or want. I'll truncate my comments to say that if I agree with Rob, and I know for a fact that it's counterintuitive to think in my school district that if a district the size of Portland Public or Gresham Barlow, Reynolds or David Douglas decided to pull out of the special education services that I purchase 50% of my $1.1 million a year from, that would be a very expensive venture for me to have to go out and provide those services for Park Rose with the leftover money that I would be given. Even if that 4.75% of the ESD dollars, which wouldn't end up 4.75% anyway, were to be given to school districts, if that was that's another thing we're hearing out there, it would not cover the expenses that I am currently using to partner with my other school districts to get the services that I need in my district. So what's a solution? Haven't heard a whole lot of solutions here, but there is a solution, and one of the things we're working on in five counties is a shared service plan. So this shared service plan has been worked on for a year and a half. I can read you the list of names of people that have been on this committee. They are a venerable and respected group of superintendents. I am one of them. I have gone to every single one of those meetings. Is how we can take our dollars and our five ESDs representing 70% of the kids served in Oregon. We have eight pilot areas that we're looking at sharing services with and get looking at systems where we can choose a system, work together, and save dollars. We have a compendium document that's going to be available that matches this shared service agreement that will show exactly how the costs are analyzed so you can see what kinds of money can be saved,
Karen,
by doing
I'd like to take a look at that.
Yes,
another
indeed.
Day. And,
indeed.
I thank
so I'll
you.
Just make my conclusion, and I'll be done.
Okay.
Okay. So my conclusion would be that we don't make decisions based on the faults of one ESD. That if Willamette ESD has problems, fix those problems, but don't judge every ESD the same way. I've gotten emails from superintendents in the Multnomah County area thanking me for going to Salem today to defend how it's working with Multnomah County ESD. While far from perfect, the ability to have resolution services to create an economy of scale with flexibility and choice is what we need. And I'll end by saying Robert Waltenberg of Grant County ESD emailed me today and told me that I am speaking on behalf of the students in Grant County when we say that we do not support the opt-out provision for school districts.
Thank you all. Thank you, Karen, for getting back to me on that
thank
question.
Thank you for allowing us to participate.
I am in big trouble here, but James Woods had to get permission from his students to come here today. So, if you could come up here and go through the highlights of your testimony, you're an economist at PSU, or a professor there, and on the board of Park Rose,
and also on the Oregon School Boards Association too. Being last means that I get to handle misconceptions, do some emphasis, do some cleanup of confusion, and it also means I get to throw away most of my notes. So that probably makes things a little bit helpful. In order to clear up the analogy that we had about the co-op, it's not the overhead cost that you should be concerned about. It's the fact that we have these fixed costs and sunk costs. So we hire an audiologist at the educational service district. Park Rose can't use a full-time audiologist. We'll take a slice of 200 hours. David Douglas will take six, and Centennial will take another six. And what we're looking at there is this giant chunk of fixed cost. Now, when one of the larger school districts goes ahead and removes itself from service, what happens is the fixed cost remains, and the pricing model for the educational service districts is relatively simple. All they got to do is cover their costs. So their choice is raise the prices or get rid of the service. So the simple example, you have a service that costs $100 a day, 100 people use it, $1 per. If only 10 people use it, well, it's $10 per, and sometimes that doesn't exactly make sense. Larger districts are the ones that are more likely to be able to handle these economies of scale. They can afford to purchase this big chunk of a fixed cost or these other sunk costs that are right there. And when they leave the fixed cost, but the revenue doesn't stay. So what you're looking at here is the educational service districts look at this reduction of expenditures there, and the choice is raise prices or eliminate services. So if they leave, it means that this is the choices that are left for the rest of us. Now, we've been talking as if it's all the expenditures that are important to us. Really, all we're talking about are the resolution dollars, the stuff that is fixed within the Educational Service District. We spend our money elsewhere all the time. It's just this part that's allocated to the Educational Service District. Some school districts don't spend it all. They don't. They have a credit sitting around. I've heard about this. We spend more in our allocation because our Educational Service District provides us with extremely good prices, valuable services. I love them. They come every year and explain all the good things that they do, and I'm very happy about it. So it's my contention that Senate Bill 250 won't exactly solve the problem, but will actually make it so that larger school districts are likely to leave, smaller school districts are likely to stay, they're likely to have higher prices for the services and fewer services. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't fix the ESDs fairly easily, and what you're looking for here is greater competition, and also a better connection between us, the school districts, the ones that are the primary customers, and the educational service districts. So the first request that I have is you reconsider governance models to make it so that the constituent school boards are able to elect board members on the educational service district. It'd be nice to go and throw a superintendent there, or a business manager, or a board member, or a extremely well-informed citizen to put on those boards and represent our best interests there. Not that Jerry doesn't do a fabulous job of this, I have to go ahead and point out.
We have a bill that does just that over in the House.
Second one is to go ahead and add these competitive pressures. Educational service districts should be able to compete with each other. So I should be able to take my resolution funds, and if I find out that, say, Washington County ESD is able to provide me with an audiologist for less than Multnomah County ESD, I should be able to take those resolution dollars and transfer them over. Competition between the ESDs is healthy, and that'll reduce your costs. Second thing, the ESDs need to be able to form large agglomerations in order to do things which are actually at scale larger than an ESD. ESDs are great for things like audiologists, a new school that's going to go ahead and help our pregnant mothers. Not so good for things like, say, payroll processing. Minimum efficient scale on that is probably half a state, something an ESD can't necessarily do. And by allowing them to agglomerate, you can actually get these larger scale efficiencies you can't get with the current system. And third, and here's the important part, and this gets to both of your issues, is that the school districts should be allowed to compete vigorously with ESDs, but that has to be in such a way that the other school districts within the educational service district can actually get the benefits of that competition. So if we have one of the school districts that is able to negotiate a contract for nurses, which is lower than what the ESD could do, the other school district should be able to take the resolution dollars, contract through the ESD, back down to the other school district, and get them at the same price. So again, it's a matter of setting up a system of competitions for your cost reductions, allowing them to expand for scale efficiencies. And I hope I managed to collect most of the criticisms that I'd heard over the last, what is it, hour and a half.
Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you. Do you have any additional questions?
Questions? Comments? Senator Morse?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The testimony that we've had yesterday and today is compelling on both sides of the issue. Competition coming from the private side is the juice of invention, and that's good. My concern is that if you have an opt-out, opt-in, and it's just free, flowing, you choose to be in, choose to be out. What remains, and will we be providing the services in the most efficient way for those that remain, particularly like a McKinsey that's isolated? So the other side of the equation is that the larger districts wear a different shoe, and they may have efficiencies, and by being part of an ESD, they don't realize those efficiencies in the same way. So how do we pull all this together in a way that makes sense? The other side, the other part of the equation is, what do you do with a rogue ESD in the governance model that is not doing the right thing and does get off track? How do we as policymakers address that issue? So, to me, in one sense, it makes sense to opt out, but I'm very uncomfortable opting out without knowing what the business plan would be to make certain that those kids in the small schools have the same opportunities that the kids in the big schools do. So to me, I see this more as a phased process. You know where you're going, and you're comfortable doing it, knowing that, in fact, it's a model that works. And then the other side of the issue is the governance. I'm wondering if it isn't time for us to consider in the state some type of a state regional director of ESDs that can help rationalize all of these disparate pieces into a more efficient method of delivery.
I can address the point about the opting out. My intention with the competition between the ESDs and the school districts was to have as the requirement of removing some of your funds for the service that you're providing, that is a partial opting out of a specific service. That's the method of opting out, is just the amount of specific service, but always tied to this is this requirement that you contract with the other school districts within the educational service district in order to provide those services. So if you find a way of doing things for lower cost, you need to go ahead and make sure that you provide the service for those other school districts too. So it is another competitive force that's there. And given that this is now an avenue that's open to those other larger school districts, it means it can actually be a revenue source for them. So they should have some additional incentives to pursue those when they would not have before, because they're receiving their services from the educational service district. Second item was about dealing with the rogue ESDs. Governmental units will, you know, on occasion displease their constituencies. And the usual, we try to vote them out at the particular time. But the thing is with the ESDs, they're from the population as a whole, and oftentimes you can ask somebody on the street, hey, what educational service district are you in, and what services do you receive, and they have no idea whatsoever. The ones that are the most immediate customer are the school districts, and that's why I advocated, of course, having us be the ones that actually vote for the educational school district boards. Did I address your concern, sir?
A little bit. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Woods. Thank all of you. We're not going to take any action on this bill today, but it's continuing to evolve. I really do thank you all for your engagement, particularly those of you who traveled to near and far over the hills and through the valleys from McKenzie and up the river and down the river. Hopefully we won't leave you up the river. So thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing, and we are adjourned.